the doctor feels like on the operating table, I guess, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, look, lovely to see you. And I'm going to read various poems. It's quite interesting, you said you were short on poems and long on anecdote. I sometimes think that's what I mostly write, is anecdote. Perhaps there isn't a poem. That's what some people have accused me of, anyway. So look, let's begin at the beginning. Where else? There was a competition in the paper. Write a story. And the best story would be printed. I thought I'd go for it. I started thinking about Solomon the Cat, a book I'd read at school about how Solomon gets thrown out and goes from house to house asking for somewhere to be put up. I thought, I could write a story like that. I called it Solomon the Cat. And I wrote how Solomon gets thrown out and goes from house to house asking for somewhere to be put up. I sent it in and I won the competition. And it was printed in the paper, Solomon the Cat by Michael Rosen, aged 7. It got printed in the paper's Christmas annual too, Solomon the Cat by Michael Rosen, aged 7. Sometime later, we got a letter from the paper saying that they'd heard from someone who said they'd bought a picture book about a cat called Solomon, who gets thrown out and goes from house to house asking for somewhere to be put up. See this, Connie? My dad says to my mum. See this? Someone's stolen Michael's story and made a book out of it. Would you believe it, the things people do? If I had the time, he said, if I had the time, I'd try and get hold of that book and sue the pants off them. No, I said, no, I shouldn't bother. It was ages ago. Not long ago, I got a letter from a girl in America. She said she had won a state poetry competition judged by the poet John Chardy. She had won with a poem that went, down behind the dustbin, I met a dog called Jim. He didn't know me, and I didn't know him. You wrote that poem, Mr. Rosen, she said, and now they want to print it in the paper. What shall I do? And I sent her a letter back saying, don't worry. I know someone who once wrote a story called Solomon the Cat, who gets thrown out. Exactly, that's right. So that's how it all began, anyway. I often explain to children that when I was very young, I think my parents were quite enthusiastic about me, and they observed me. They observed everything I did. It was part of their job. But, you know, they kind of... sort of the interest waned a little bit as I got older, and I realised that what was much more exciting, rather than waiting to be observed, was to start observing them. And the first thing I found out, I often explain this to children, is that I found out that my dad does not know everything. And this was quite a discovery, really. I don't know when you discovered it, but this was how I discovered it. You'll be able to join in with this one. We sit down to eat, and the potato's a bit hot. So I only put a little bit on my fork and I blow till it's cool, just cool, into the mouth. Nice. And there's my brother, he's doing the same. You can join in now, here we go. Till it's cool, just cool, into the mouth. This bit's a good bit, here we go. Nice. And there's my mum, she's doing the same. Yes, I did come from that sort of a home. Here we go, are we ready? All together. Till it's cool, just cool. Into the mouth. Nice. But my dad, what does he do? He stuffs a great big chunk of potato into his mouth. And that really does it. His eyes pop out. He bobs his head up and down. He blows, he puffs, he yells. He spits a potato onto the plate. And he turns to us and he says, watch out, everybody, the potato's really hot. Well, we kind of knew that, didn't we? Yeah, that's right. Okay. My parents were what Hitler used to call Jewish communists. Yeah, they were parents as well. I don't know how they managed that. It was extraordinary, really. But they did. And if you were brought up as a communist, Americans have got that lovely phrase, red diaper kids, I think is what they call them. You have quite sort of strange experiences. Malk's shoes smelt of fish because they were stuck together with fish glue. His father had brought them back from Czechoslovakia. They were, his father said, another example of how communism was improving the lives of the Czechoslovakian people. See how resourceful they are, he said, using fish remains to make shoes. Nothing gets wasted. At nights, when we lay in his bedroom, Malk in his bed, me on the floor in my sleeping bag, we would talk about the girls we fancied, and in the dark, I could smell his communist shoes. here's another little scene from Jewish communist life, but a bit more oblique than that. You may remember, some of you, you look old enough in the room to remember that before this Tory coalition government, we had a Labour government, and before the Labour government, we had a Tory government. They've all been incredibly different, totally different policies and so on, as we know. And one of the highlights of that Tory government all those years ago was when Tory politicians used to give us advice. We needed that. We needed advice, particularly to parents. If you, I was a dad, still am. And the advice we got were things like, somebody like Cecil Parkinson, a fine, upstanding person like that, some of you may remember him, and he said, the trouble with society today is that parents don't teach their children the difference between right and wrong. And I thought, well, that's very illuminating. No, I'd never thought of that before. So I sat down and I thought, did my Jewish communist parents, see how aberrant they were, did they teach me the difference between right and wrong? And this is the story that floated to the surface. I nagged my parents for a torch. I'd love a torch. Oh, go on. One of those ones with the black rub around them. Oh, go on, please. It was no good. I wasn't getting anywhere. And then came my birthday. On the table was a big box. In the box, a torch. My dad took it out the box. You see that torch, he says? It's waterproof. That is a waterproof torch. Waterproof. So that night, I got into the bath and went underwater swimming with it. Breathe in, under the water, switch on, search for shipwrecks and treasure, up, breathe, under again, exploring the ocean floor. Then the torch went out. I shook it and banged it, but it wouldn't go. I couldn't get it to go again, my birthday torch. So I got out the bath, dried myself off, put on my pyjamas and went into the kitchen. The torch, it won't work, it's broken. And my dad says, what do you mean it's broken? It couldn't have just broken. How did it break? I don't know. It just went off. I don't believe it. You ask him a simple question and you never get a simple answer. You must have been doing something with it. No! It just went off. Look, just try telling the truth, will you? How did it break? I was underwater swimming with it. Are you mad? When I said this torch is waterproof, I meant it keeps the rain off. I didn't mean you could go bloody deep sea diving with it. Ruined, completely ruined. For weeks and weeks, he nags as stupid that he wants one of these waterproof torches. And the first thing he does is wreck it. How long did it last? 2 minutes, Connie? 3 minutes? These things cost money, you know, money. At the weekend, he says, we're going into Harrow to take the torch back. We walk into the shop. My dad goes up to the man at the counter and he says, you see this torch? I bought it from you a couple of weeks ago. It's broken. So the man picks it up. Well, it couldn't have just broken, says the man. How did it break? And my dad says, I don't know, it just went off. Well, surely you must have been doing something with it. No. No, no, says my dad, it just went off. Oh, come on, says the man, these torches don't just break down. You must have been doing something with it. So I said, well, actually, yeah, I was in the, and I got a kick on the ankle from my dad. I was in the what? Oh, right. in the kitchen. And it went off. So the man said he'd be taking it out the back to show Len, and he came back a few minutes later and said that Len couldn't get it to work either. You'll have to have a new one, he says. I should think so too, says my dad. Thank you. Outside the shop, my dad says to me, what's the matter with you? You were going to tell him all about your underwater swimming fandango, weren't you? Are you crazy? Well, that was how I found out the difference between right and wrong. Anyway, here's my mum. My mum was very good at monologues, as you'll hear. My mother said she wasn't going to go on another camping trip until we got a better frying pan. I'm not going camping ever again with a frying pan without a handle. Who ever heard of cooking with a frying pan without a handle? If you did more of the cooking, you wouldn't want to cook with a frying pan without a handle. Everyone else who goes camping goes with a nice frying pan, but when we go camping, we go with a frying pan without a handle. It's typical of your father. He goes out, gets a new tent, he gets a new lamp, he gets a new sleeping bag, but I'm cooking with a frying pan without a handle. I've sat there for hours and hours trying to fry onions, trying to fry liver, trying to fry bacon and eggs, and I'm trying to do it all with a frying pan without a handle. There are good frying pans these days. I've seen them. People go camping with them. Not rich people, people like us. They sit there every night with their nice frying pans, having a nice time. But what have we got? A frying pan? Exactly. I sense a little bit of sort of rage there, sort of from one or two people in the room. You got on with it, yeah. And here she is again. I ran away from home. I said, I'm going on the Aldermaston march to ban the bomb. They said this was out of the question. The boy's mad. Crazy. My mother said, where will you stay? You'd have nothing to eat. You don't know anyone. What would you eat? You're not going. Harold, say something. He's too young. Look at him. He's packing. You can't go without a spare pair of trousers. How can he carry a bag like that for 20 miles a day? Stop him, Harold. What would you do in the evening? You need to eat. You get ill if you don't eat. Take a tin of beans. Eh? You can always eat beans. Harold, stop him. There's the chicken. Take the chicken. If you're taking a tin of beans, take two. He's 13, Harold. Go next year. Yeah? Wait till next year. They won't have banned the bomb by then, believe me. There'll be another march. Go on that one. You must keep eating fresh fruit. And you like dates, yeah? Yeah, he's always liked dates, hasn't he, Harold? Just squeeze them in down the side of the back. Couldn't he wait till the last day when we'll be there? We can all go to Trafalgar Square together. Harold, have you got the chicken? Just because it's Easter doesn't mean it's warm. It can snow at Easter. Wear the string vest. Who's organised the coaches? Do we know these people, Harold? One orange. Take five. And raisins. He's 13. It's ridiculous. He can't go. Keep the chicken wrapped. Phone us if you need more food. Goodbye. So that was how my mum stopped me from going on the Aldermaston march. And here she is again. I've been a bit sparse, I've noticed this, with the Yiddish. My parents did speak Yiddish. My mum was brought up as a Yiddish speaker. Yiddish is a language that Jews take about 5 hours to explain. At the end of it, you have no idea what they're talking about. I'll try and keep it brief. It's a kind of medieval German dialect with bits of sort of Russian and Hebrew chucked in. There's various words that you know that come from Yiddish, words like nosh and so on. In this one, there is a word, a schlump. A schlump is somebody who, no matter what clothes they wear, they end up looking schlumpy. That's right, yes, good. So there you've got the idea. Okay, and so here's my mum again in one of her monologues. My mother didn't often shout at me, but when she was fed up, she would go in for long speeches, during which she wouldn't hear anything you'd say. I'm tired of seeing you in those trousers. Why don't you go to the men's shop in the high street? What's it called? Harry Boothroyd's. No, Mum, there's two. One's called Harry Reid and the other's called John Booth. That little man under the bridge, he'd fit you up with a nice pair of trousers. Harry Boothroyd, he's got no mum. One's called Harry Reid and the other's called John Booth. He's got nice trousers. You look a complete schlump in those trousers. I'll give you the money now. You could go to that Harry Boothroyd tomorrow. No, mum. One's called Harry Reid and the other's called John Booth. You could look smart. Those trousers are a disgrace. I'm ashamed to see you wearing them. I'm sure the Stoller boy doesn't wear trousers like that. Doesn't he get his trousers at Harry Boothroyd's? No, mum. He gets his trousers either at Harry Reid's or John Booth, mum. So what's the matter with you? Don't you want to look smart? All this don't care what I look like stuff, where'd you get it from? Hmm? You don't see me going about looking untidy. Your father maybe, but even he goes and gets himself a couple of suits from Harry Boothroyd's. No, mum. He goes to either Harry Reid's or John Booth's, mum. I'm giving you the money. Go now and don't come back until you got yourself a pair of trousers. I can't bear looking at you another minute. Well, which one shall I go to, mum? Harry Reid's or John Booth's? And she said, how should I know? I haven't heard of either of them. I got a new book coming out, which is called Michael's Big Book of Bad Things, and I just thought I'd read you one or two from there. It isn't out yet. This is just nice to kind of feel a book in your hand that sort of isn't out yet, really. So you know what writers do when books come out, first thing they... Yeah. Okay, my parents both work. My mum was a primary school teacher, my dad was a secondary school teacher, and if any of you were brought up by parents who both work, or in fact if you're in a relationship and you both work and you've got children, you might recognise this. I noticed when I was a teenager that my parents used to go in for tiredness competitions. So I'd sit there and maybe I'd get home first and they would get in later, and then the whole of the evening would be taken up with this tiredness competition. So I was quite a stroppy teenager, surprise, surprise, and so I've put in a little appearance at the end. Dad says, phew, I'm tired. Mum says, you're tired. I'm tired. And Dad says, I've never, ever been as tired as this. And Mum says, you don't know what tired is. I'll tell you what tired is. It's me. That's what tired is. And Dad says, I'm tired all over. It's my legs. It's my head. And Mum says, my tired isn't just inside. Everywhere's tired. And Dad says, I haven't even begun to tell you how tired I am. And Mum says, I know how tired you are. You've told me. And you know something? You telling me you're tired makes me tired. And Dad says, and that's it. No one understands how tired I am. No one listens. In the end, I get tired saying I'm tired. And Mum says, what you don't know is that before I was this tired, I didn't know a person could be this tired. If I had known then how tired I was going to be, I wouldn't have let myself get this tired. And I say, anyone round here tired? Anyway. And then I have a lovely daughter who's 9 years old, and one of the reasons for her loveliness is that she nags me to tell stories about how awful I was. And so she keeps pushing the limits, if you like, and I tell the next awful one. She said, you must have done something worse than that, Dad. And I kind of scrape the brain a bit more, and then I discover something. And then this came out of one of those conversations. You might finally be able to join in with this one as we go. I loved sharing my bedroom with my brother. But one day, my parents said that my brother was going to move out of our room. He was going to have a room of his own. We wouldn't share anymore. So he moved out the model cars he had made and the model trains and the model planes, and they all went off to the room next door, his room. In there, he set up the model cars he had made and the model trains and the model planes, and soon he got to work making something new, something really big. I wanted to be in there while he was making it, but I had to go to bed in my room, the room that used to be our room. So I had an idea. I had a metal ruler, a hard steel ruler with sharp edges and corners, and I got into bed with this metal ruler, and just where the bed meets the wall, just out of sight of anyone looking, I started to scratch the wall with the hard corner of the metal ruler. Scratch, 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 scrape, scrape, scrape. I was making a hole through to my brother's bedroom. I twisted the corner of the metal ruler round and round and round. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Scrape, scrape, scrape. After hours, ages of scratching and scraping, all I'd made was a tiny little dent in the wall. So I went to sleep. The next night, I got working at it again. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Scrape, scrape, scrape. The dent got a tiny bit deeper. And the next night, and the next. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Scrape, scrape, scrape. After a few nights, I reached a bit of wood. Should I try to scrape through the wood or around it? I decided to go over the top. But this would make the hole wider and maybe someone would see it. But I didn't care. I had to go on. I had to make the hole. I had to get through to my brother's room. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Scrape, scrape, scrape. It was now a little cave in the wall, a secret tunnel. I wet my fingers in my drink, then dabbed the dry plaster with my fingers. The plaster went dark. The secret tunnel was wet. What if I could shrink myself down and crawl through it? Be an explorer, bravely climbing through the dangerous cave. Will I get through, or will I be trapped in here forever? Just then my dad popped his head round the door. Good night, Mick, he said all cheerily. I hadn't heard him coming. Oh no, he mustn't see it. So I sat up in the bed and quickly twisted round to cover up the hole in the wall. He mustn't see the hole. But he saw me doing this sitting up twisty round thing. Oh no, he'd seen me. Instead of going back downstairs, he opened the door, walked into the room. Still cheery, he says, hey, what's that you're doing? And what are you covering up there? Nothing. Now, come on, Mick, look at you. I can see from the way you're sitting, you're covering up something. No. Still cheery. He says, oh, come on, come away from the wall. Let me have a look. What could I do? I had to let him see. So I leaned forward. And he saw it straight away. The hole in the wall. Oh, no. It's the moment when the cheery stuff stops. It's the moment when the cheery stuff stops. He stood there staring at the hole in the wall. He pointed at it. What's that? He says, it's a hole in the wall. I said, I can see it's a hole in the wall, he says, but how in heaven's name did you make a hole in the bedroom wall? With this. And I pulled the metal ruler out from under the covers. He slapped his hand on his forehead. You've wrecked the wall, he says. He shouted for my mum. Connie, come and look at this. Come and look at it. And of course my brother comes running along behind her. All three of them stood by my bed, staring at the hole in the wall. Look what he's done, says my dad. Look at it. Look at it. He's wrecked the wall. It's wrecked. Oh, Michael, says my mum. And my brother is giggling and giggling. It must have taken him ages, he says. And mummy's saying, but Michael, what did you think you were doing? Why did you do it? And I said, I was trying to get through to Brian's room. And my brother says, but Mick, you could have just got up, walked out the door, walked across the landing and in through my door. Anyway, there you go. There's the hole in the wall. Okay. How are we doing for time here? Is it, yeah? I thought maybe I'll read you. Here's one more little picture of my mum. There was a typhoid outbreak in South America, and they told us that we shouldn't eat corned beef. Don't eat corned beef. Don't eat Frey Bentos. My mother went to the cupboard, and it was stacked up with corned beef cans. We always had cupboards full of supplies. We must never, ever be short of food, ever. Families, friends might walk in. She took one of the cans down and looked at it. Better not open that till the typhoid outbreak's over, she said. And sometimes I sort of try a kind of different thing, sort of like a reverie type poem. It goes like this. I think I know why cats eat grass. Something to do with them knowing that all's not well in their guts. So they eat grass, which makes them sick. Then whatever it was that was making them unwell has gone. It's not inside anymore, it's outside, evacuated. This is not the same as the hairball. Eating their own hair also makes them sick, But that's because they lick themselves. The hair just goes in. What I don't know is why cats put the sick where they put it. They bring it to our doorstep. You can tell which sick is from grass eating and which from hair. The grass eating sick is a pool of foamy, sticky stuff with bits of chewed grass in it. The hairball sick is more solid, food mixed in and held together by a wodge of hairs. That way you can tell which of the cats has done it. So some of the hairy sick is ginger. As the sun dries it and the rain washes it, we're left with a skein of ginger hair, like the twist of wool you find on barbed wire when sheep have pushed through. The mystery, though, is why the cats want to bring us their sick. It feels so like an offering, an act of kindness or generosity, but that doesn't seem likely. When you watch a cat being sick, it looks like they're trying to bring up their whole system. Anything could come out. A kidney, maybe. Is it a way of saying they hate us? We sick on you and all that you stand for. Or maybe they think we're mummy, and they just do things like being sick when they're around mummy, because deep inside they know that mummy will clear it up, give them more dinner, and lick them all over. Either that, or just doing what you do with good friends. You could do anything with good friends. If you were a football match and you wet yourself, a good friend wouldn't stand up and shout, "Hey, look, my friend's wet himself." He would just nod and say, "Yeah, right, yeah." Now, I do that sometimes, yeah. Even if he didn't. Bearing that in mind, I just want to say that the cats are okay. They're good to be with. And that sick thing, I didn't mean to draw too much attention to it. I do it myself sometimes. Okay, and then just a couple to finish off. I like writing about just things that I see or hear. He said, "I can't stand it anymore. It's doing me head in. This place used to be like a village." "What's the matter with it?" I said. "It's full of foreigners," he said. "I love Wolverhampstow," he said, "but I can't stay here. I'm going." I wondered where, but I said nothing. He didn't say anything else, so I said, "Where to?" "Spain," and then I'll finish with this one. And this is really a sort of, I think it was Sarah, wasn't it? You mentioned about the city and the suburbs. I was brought up in the suburbs, but my roots were in the city, in the East End, in Hackney and so on. And I've kind of gone back to Hackney. Does anyone know the 38 bus? Yeah. Good. And the 73 bus? That just about covers everything. So as I'm reading this, just think 38. 73. The bus goes on and it's full and it's leaving and it's laughing and it's going on and it's morning and it's evening and it's in Punjabi and it's daytime and it's full and it stops and it's suspicious and it starts and it's in Igbo and it's shouting and it's shopping and it's rapping and it's lit up and it's dark and it's "Shove up, will ya?" and it's crying and it's squealing and it's in Dutch and it's braking and it's in Geordie and it's at the station and it's skint and it's full of babies and it's full of men and it's going on and it's past the Vietnamese cafe and it's past the tire depot and it's past the silver car and its chauffeur and it's waiting for Sinatra to start up, and it's in Patois, and it's chips and vinegar, and it's past the park, and it's full of football, and it's a bellyache, and it's full of jokes, and it's scared, and it's in Arabic, and it's back from school, and it's pushing, and it's raining, and it's, whoa, right, armpits, man, and it's tranks, and it's angry, and it's full of yesterday, and it's riding under the lights, and it's fucked off, and it's the smell of oil, and it's pissed, and it's combing, and it's kissing, and it's packets of rice, and it's cassava, and it's over the canal, and it's the baby's bottle, and it's over the railway, and it's under the cranes, and it's in the shadows of the palaces in glass, and it's in Albanian, and it's bleach, and it's the homework in late, and it's spuds, and it's the hijab, and it's shoulders next to backs, next to fronts, and it's revving, and it's too late, and it's too early, and it's not enough, and it's going on, and it's on time, and it's dreaming, and it'll get there today, and it'll get there tomorrow.